Hello and welcome to Film Wonk. This is Glenn. I'm here with Daniel.
Hello.
And tonight we're going to be reviewing the new film from writer-director Wes Anderson, The Grand Budapest Hotel, starring Ralph Fiennes, F. Murray Abraham, Jeff Goldblum, Willem Dafoe, Adrian Brody, Harvey Keitel, Jude Law, Bill Murray, Edward Norton, and an appropriately large cast for a Wes Anderson film, as well as newcomer Tony Revolori, who plays the character of Zero Mustafa, who is actually one of the leads in this film. But as a result of all of the powerhouses that we just mentioned being in the film, he appears a bit farther down in the credits, as is tradition. We also have Saoirse Ronan in this film as well. And Daniel, is it fair to say that this movie is whimsical in nature?
On the surface, yes.
How do you mean?
Well, looking at the trailer, the movie I thought I was going to see was a comedy.
Yeah, and one with hijinks surrounding, yes, an old-timey fancy
and
hotel.
Zany sex characters, everything.
Yep.
The movie we got was zany on the surface with the characters, the sex, the costumes, but an undercurrent of darkness a la Catch-22.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Almost what almost felt like a rip from the headlines sort of vibe. Granted, Wes Anderson couldn't have known what was going to happen in the Crimea this year when he was making this film.
Well, we don't know if he's part of the Illuminati.
That's true. That's true. He could be.
This is a coincidence.
I mean, he's got Bill Murray in his film, so presumably
right.
He is. Because Bill Murray doesn't come out for just anyone. It's Zombieland and then this. So this film, as it appears on the surface, it is about this grand old Budapest hotel in a fictitious Eastern European Republic, whose name actually escapes me right now.
It's like Zubrovka.
Zubrovka, yeah.
Like Hungary.
Yeah, like Hungary. Like Hungary, cum Poland, or something like that.
It's a little bit Austria mixed in.
Yeah. And this country of Zubrovka doesn't exist anymore in the present day, and that's where we begin, is in the present day with Tom Wilkinson playing the oldest version of this author. And I have to say, I'm going to get this right out of the beginning. I did not understand why we needed a story within a story within a story. I thought, you know, the two layers deep was enough, because what we get immediately is Tom Wilkinson flashing back to when he first heard the story of the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Which we then flash back
further to that actual story in the 1930s, something
yes,
like that. Yeah,
takes place in the 30s.
Yeah, so I mean, the bulk of the conversation in the quote-unquote present days takes place in the 1980s between F. Murray Abraham and Jude Law, who plays the younger version of Tom Wilkinson. So I really just did not understand what Tom Wilkinson was doing in this movie at all.
Yeah, unnecessary layer, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, when we flash back to the present day, at the end of the film, we learn that it was inspired by the works of an author who's not mentioned during the film. Inspired by the works of Stefan Zweig, an author that I'm not familiar with, but I guess that is the justification for it being set in the present day. Maybe this author has just died or something like that.
I believe the author committed suicide in the 40s.
Oh, well, in that case, I have no idea. So, the present day, really nothing happens other than just some generic Wes Anderson weirdness, like a kid pointing a BB gun at him and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, but there's also the girl reading the story of the Grand Budapest Hotel at the cemetery.
At the cemetery, yeah, where presumably Tom Wilkinson is buried, which makes me wonder, like, is that another flashback?
That's another layer.
Yeah, like we've got the present day, then we flash back slightly to Tom Wilkinson telling the story.
When he first heard about the story, to when he heard about the story, to the story.
Yeah, now, of course, once we get into the deepest two layers of the story, which is the kind of dilapidated Grand Budapest Hotel in the 80s, which still exists, and the owner of that hotel, Zero Mustafa, played by F. Murray Abraham, telling the story to Jude Law of how he came to own that hotel. And then, of course, the deepest flashback of the 1930s. All of that comes together pretty nicely. And I thought those two time periods worked really well.
The two most modern periods, yeah, didn't work as well. Didn't make as much sense. But yeah, the two tight-knit storylines do work.
Well, yeah, so I want to talk about just the way this movie is made in general. This movie is, I remarked to you as we were walking out, that is a movie that was not interested in realism.
It sure wasn't.
At all. it uses, both in terms of the visual look of the film, because a lot of times we see what are obvious models of the Grand Budapest Hotel, of all the stuff surrounding the mountain, ski lifts, and actual skiing at one point, and things that are obviously just little bits of model-based fakery. And this is a movie that was just didn't care. It wasn't interested in that.
So then you have to ask the question as to what did it care about?
Well, I would also say it takes that disinterest in realism even further when it comes to the depiction of the family of the deceased woman that is kind of the central plot this movie revolves around. This old widow, one of Ralph Fiennes' many elderly friends that he goes to bed with.
Well, he goes to bed with all his friends.
Exactly, yes. He, played by Tilda Swinton, I might add, Madame D, I believe her name is. She dies, and Ralph Fiennes as Gustav is as Monsieur Gustav is framed for her murder, and also there's a whole drama surrounding the inheritance and whether or not he'll get this painting called Boy with Apple,
a priceless painting.
Yeah, but really, everything surrounding them is like something out of a Roald Dahl book, but it's like an R-rated Roald Dahl book. Like, they're a very zany and cartoonishly evil family. Adrian Brody, who is the evil Dimitri, and then we have just the most messed up version of Willem Dafoe I think I've seen since this side of Antichrist.
I think he's found his calling.
Yes, as a hitman known as Jopling. And in the midst of it all, we have Jeff Goldblum as the lawyer and the executor of Madame D's estate. And really, all of these things that I just mentioned, which are full of just dastardly people doing dastardly things, they're really just delightful. It's just a lot of fun.
It is. It does beg the question whether or not the style trumps the substance. And it does a little bit, because the substance that we do get, while dark, didn't really seem to have an overlying message.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I'm thinking back to other Wes Anderson films. He did a movie called The Darjeeling Limited a few years ago, and that movie also dealt with some fairly dark subject matter, and ultimately not for that much of a point and purpose. And it makes me wonder, you know, do we take a movie that's telling a fairly dire story about warfare and crime and these fairly dark themes, and we put it in this slick little wrapper that apparently uses every filmmaking trick that Wes Anderson learned while making The Fantastic Mr. Fox, like of just incorporating these cartoonish bits into his real world. And does the end product just come off as being a little bit slight? Like, what is the point of this movie?
Well, yeah, they introduced what was obvious a reference to the SS and communism.
Yeah, there are fascists in this movie.
Yes, and the Madame D's family is all ardent fascists.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they have this double Z symbol that they wear on their armbands. I mean, it's very unsubtle imagery.
Yeah, which looks an awful lot like the Einsatzgruppen death squad symbol.
Look at you. Yeah. Well, but also not trying to be subtle in the least. I mean, that's what I kept coming back to with this movie was, one, I had a great time watching it. It is very funny. It is very kind of wryly funny at times, especially Ralph Fiennes' character. And that is where I think this movie's substance really comes from, is this idea of him being, of both him and the hotel itself kind of being out of their time, or, you know, they were just products of a bygone era. Even when this story was taking place, they already felt just a little bit out of place. Well, he's fancy almost to a ridiculous degree.
So here's the thing about hospitality, as somebody who works in hospitality.
Oh, please.
That's very true. Working in a hotel is a whole different universe. It doesn't feel like a real place. It feels a lot like how the Grand Budapest portrays itself in the film. Both how you treat your guests, how you think of the hotel, how you think of it as a stylish, it's beautiful, it's your home, every detail has to be perfect, everything has to go perfectly, the uniforms have to be pressed. It's all into that world, that illusion that they build. And yes, it's out of place and out of time, just like every hotel is. Every hotel that's a resort hotel.
Interesting.
It definitely has that vibe. Like, I don't work at a resort hotel, but I work at a hotel that's still share some things in common with how the Grand Budapest Hotel portray itself.
Yeah, I mean, the Grand Budapest Hotel really, the actual hotel now we're talking about, actually, it reminded me of, like, Hearst Castle. I mean, it had all of these different imported bits of luxury from other places, like the Turkish baths, which were really just giant bathtubs, but they were, you know, fancy-looking bathtubs with intricate tile
works. The wall paint being the bright red or bright orange.
This is a movie which, for indulging in lots of bits of fakery when it came to its more zany effects bits, they actually clearly spent a lot of money on costumes and sets and just the set details, the intricate woodwork and all these things, just to make this place look authentic.
So I stripped that away a little bit.
Yeah.
So the relationships are very important. Both Gustav, His mentorship with Zero is a very important, you know, very important relationship.
Yeah, I would say those two are probably in 80% of the scenes in this movie.
And
so it's
Zero's a straight man. So as a straight man, he played it very well. I think as a refugee, trying to work his way up in the world, like working obscene amounts of hours as the lobby boy, being the eyes and ears of the hotel. I think he did a great job with his performance.
Well, yeah, I like that he also kind of feels like a Roald Dahl character because he's likable, but he's also capable. He has things that he wants, and he has, you know, he has will and desire of his own.
He's very able,
Oh, and there's a girl he likes. We've got Saoirse Ronan here, for once in her native Irish accent, although I actually learned just this morning that she was born in New York City and moved to and grew up in Ireland when she was three.
Usually the reverse is true.
Indeed. So... So what I presume to be her native Irish accent is on display in this movie, and that's another detail that I wanted to mention as far as this movie being uninterested in realism, is that the accents were all over the place in this movie.
Edward Norton did his own accent.
Edward Norton was doing an Edward Norton accent. Owen Wilson, but of course I expect that from him, who shows up very briefly.
As one of the other hotel proprietors.
Yep, Jason Schwartzman, who shows up in a similar role. Actually, also Bill Murray, who plays one of the let's just say he plays another hotel employee, and we'll get into the details of that in spoilers. But
this film actually was a little bit jarring in how violent it was. It was surprisingly violent.
Yeah,
I was really not expecting. The violence. It came out of left field a little bit, and it seemed. It definitely felt a little bit like Catch-22, and that there's a lot of violence in that film, but it's glossed over in fun and whimsy and zaniness.
Well, yeah, that's kind of where the tone of this movie fluctuates between... I referred to that family that perpetrates the majority of the evil in this movie as dastardly. They feel very much like a Snidely Whiplash kind of character. They are... they're evil, but they're like mustache-twirling evil.
Adrian Brody, he's an interesting kind of evil.
Yes, and Willem Dafoe, he's a terrifying kind of evil.
He's the best kind of evil. I was like, if anyone ever deserved to be a Nazi and be a member of the SS, Willem Dafoe.
Well, I got the feeling, and granted, we get to know them just enough as we see through their actions, because they have almost no dialogue in the film, but especially Willem Dafoe. But I got the feeling he was really just a hired goon. You know, he might be absolutely loyal to this family, but I got the feeling they are the dutiful party line towing, you know, Nazis or whatever.
Communists, whatever he was going for. Yeah.
And Willem Dafoe is just their goon who does their bidding, was kind of how I thought it. Yeah, exactly. He's just a little outsourced talent there.
Yeah.
So I think we should go ahead and get into spoilers here because really there's not much else to talk about in terms of what happens in the movie because this is a comedy and it's either going to make you laugh or not. I think it has a very wry sense of humor to it. I found myself laughing at it a little bit more often than you did, I think I noticed. But
that's because I'm humorless.
That's true. There is no joy in your life.
Anytime anything references history at all, I start my magnifying glass comes out, and I start looking, and I start analyzing, and I start critiquing.
Well, that's an interesting point, because this is as fictitious a world as Inglourious Basterds presented to us.
But they tip their hats very often at history, especially 1930s Europe.
Well, that's the point I wanted to raise with you, was this movie is doing a very similar thing to Inglourious Basterds. It is just not marrying itself to an actual historical event and period in name. It is not claiming to be history. So did that give them a pass in your view?
It actually did.
Okay.
I enjoy the references to history. I enjoy all the little bits of the flags, the uniforms, the death squad showing up.
The death squad.
You know, that's the Einsatzgruppen.
The most amusing instance of the phrase death squad I think I've ever seen.
Exactly. So. And I, as a lover of history, I appreciated that. I appreciate those little, you know, throw me a bone. Give me something that I can be like, aha,
so
I know what you're going
for. So this is the sort of historical fiction you're okay with. The historical fiction that either latches onto a real period but uses fake people, or the historical fiction that uses fake people in a fake period but just includes references that give it a sense of authenticity.
Yes.
Okay.
If you were going to do history, do it right, or at least borrow from it, but not overtly.
Right. Well, so thinking about the Grand Budapest Hotel itself, the other movie that came to mind for me was Titanic, just because of its depiction of, and not in any way in terms of the vibe or depiction of the visual style of these movies, but just in terms of they are both places where the richest of the rich would come for luxury, basically. And the, and the idea of it, and of course, we still have resort hotels in the modern era as well, but... But I don't know. There's just something that's changed in them. They feel modern resort hotels, for lack of a better phrase, feel modern. And this, in a place like the Grand Budapest Hotel, you don't really find places like that anymore.
They're rare. I mean, they still exist, but they're pretty rare.
There's a place in Victoria, British Columbia, just up across the border from us, called the Empress Hotel. That is an actual historic hotel, and that actually really came to mind for me when I was seeing the Grand Budapest Hotel. But it's rare. It's the sort of places that like heads of state stay nowadays. You know, it's it really is a product of a bygone era. And so, for a movie that as I said was not interested in realism, I think it was interested in authenticity, and I think that it drew a pretty interesting distinction between those two points. And also, it was quite funny. I mean, I'm overemphasizing the kind of academic view of history that got provoked by watching this movie. But this movie was a ton of fun to watch.
It really was, and I appreciated all the style, you know, all the little bits, because every scene, like where the characters stand, what the backdrop looks like, what the paintings are, like all of that is very, very deliberate, and somebody took a lot of time to put that together. It's a beautiful film.
It really is
visually a treat. Where I think it kind of goes off the rails a little bit is I think some of the zaniness works against it when they're introducing some of the more serious concepts in the film.
Okay.
For instance...
I'll be careful. We're about to get into spoilers here, so it's...
I would say some of the later scenes with Joplin.
Okay.
I think the zaniness detracted from what was going on a little bit. But it's a minor critique because I think that this film was really enjoyable. And I left the theater saying, wow, there was a lot of interesting things this film brought up, and I don't normally say that. So why don't we get into spoilers?
All right, so with that, let's go ahead and get into spoilers for the Grand Budapest Hotel. If you do not wish to hear how the film ends, you should tune out now. And I would say, having seen this film, you do not want to know how the film ends. There's quite a lot of interesting stuff that happens as the movie goes on. So from here on out, spoilers ahoy.
So Agatha really got a raw deal, didn't she?
I suppose dying off screen of Prussian measles, I think, was
a little... Yes, in childbirth.
Yeah.
So, we got a dead infant, too.
Well, and also, so we not only have kind of a tragic off-screen backstory for Zero, this kid that we've been following through the movie, as well as Agatha, who, for no reason whatsoever, has a birthmark in the shape of Mexico on her cheek. I just want to call
that
out.
I was really hoping that maybe they would say she really likes spicy foods or something.
Right.
You know, but they didn't really do it. It was just a... visual, you know, addition. Like, oh, she has a birthmark. It's the shape of a country. Yay.
Yeah, little bits of, I guess I would say, purposeless zaniness. Yeah. I mean, I think it informed when, later on, when we hear, there's a scene where Agatha is in her hut alone, and she hears some noise on the roof. And I say hut because that's kind of what it looks like, but...
a garret.
Yeah, sort of. Just a little house that's right up against the roof. But anyway, she hears some noise and she looks up top and there's nothing there. And then we smash cut to a newspaper from the next day saying, young girl's head found severed in basket. Now tell me, did you think she was dead?
I actually did, because we knew that our good friend Joplin was going around killing witnesses and killing people that would be against the family.
Well, also, we didn't know any other young women at this point.
Exactly.
Like, the one who it turns out to be, the sister with the club foot, was somebody who had only been mentioned once in the previous scene.
As part of the setup. And I wouldn't say she was a young girl.
Yeah. I don't even think we saw her, like, whoever this was, I don't think we saw her on screen before.
Yes, she did.
Did we?
Yeah. Joplin goes to her house and asks if she has seen her brother.
Oh,
and
that's right.
She's like, no, and then he kills her later.
Okay, yeah. So it's Serge's sister. That's right. Okay, sorry, it's been a few days since we saw this, and there are a lot of characters in this movie. So.
And some are on screen for maybe 30 seconds at that.
Yeah, so. Serge, I think, has a combined 5 minutes of screen time, and he's a very important character, as it
plot-wise,
turns out.
Plot-wise, yes.
Yeah, plot-wise. So.
And all the hotel proprietors during the very fun scene where you're calling him favors.
Oh my, yes, that was magnificent. And this is another thing where I have to give a shout-out to the production design. These are scenes scenes where we see all these other different hotels, and each one has a name, each one has a distinctive style for both the, you know, they designed a series of uniforms for them. We see a little bit
each
of their...
Each is a different brand.
Exactly, yeah, and we see a little bit of them operationally each time, and in a great running gag of, you know, here, you take over what I'm doing.
And I'll tell you, as someone who works at a hotel... my hotel recently hosted a international GM conference.
GM as a general manager.
General manager. So the head guy for the hotel, the CEO of the hotel. And so it was probably, I think, 1,000 across, you know, the world coming together for this big GM conference. And yeah, it's very true. They're all very eccentric, you know, kind of type A rich people all together at a rich people conference.
Now, were they all wearing distinctive uniforms or were they just wearing suits?
They were just wearing suits. I'll tell you one instance, and I know this is away from the review, but the elevator doors open and there was a wall of suits and the GM of my hotel, and they all turned to look at me, and there was a spot in the elevator for one extra body, and I said... Yeah, I'll take the next one.
Right. Well, as we know from this movie, now granted, you're not a lobby boy at the hotel.
I'm not a lobby boy, no. I'm a little bit higher up.
But as anybody below the GM, you were to be seen and not heard. So you should have just given them a terse nod and let the doors close.
I certainly did.
Don't worry, you'll be fired next week over it.
I'm pretty sure he only vaguely knows my name.
Excellent. So really all the hotel behind the scenes dynamics were quite fun. All the little sermons that Gustav gives to all of his guys while they're having dinner.
Yeah, they have to eat in like 10 seconds. But yep, he gives these rousing sermons.
Yeah, composes poems and all these different things. So let's talk about prison, because that's the one thing that didn't come up in pre-spoilers here. Mr. Gustav goes to prison for awaiting trial for murder.
He does very well for himself.
Yes, he does. He immediately gets in with his cellmates who happen to be hatching an escape plan. Like, how lucky is that, you know?
He got in with the right people. It's all about connections and networking.
And one of those people turns out to be Harvey Keitel, shaved bald. I initially had a hard time recognizing him. Shaved bald, shirtless, and covered with very poorly scrawled tattoos.
He really should sue his tattoo artist for his incompetence.
Probably, but I get the feeling he's probably shanked him already, so nothing to worry about there.
He didn't pay the bill, is what you're saying.
Yes. And they go on an escape plot here.
I love the prison uniforms.
Oh, yeah, the stripes. you almost picture somebody running away with, like, a sack full of money with
exactly,
a dollar sign.
Exactly, with the dollar sign on the outside, yeah.
And this is, I think, an area where I would agree that the violence kind of... It almost feels like as the movie goes on, Gustav and Zero become inured to the violence that's happening around them. I mean, they're part of this escape plot, and a guy jumps into the guard shack and just murders these guards who are playing poker, just stabbing them.
Stabs all five. But he dies too. And they play it off as a joke.
Yeah, and there's really quite a lot of that. Like, there's a lot of violence in the movie that happens kind of out of nowhere and somewhat jarringly shifting the tone of the movie. Like when Jeff Goldblum gets killed, Deputy Kovacs, the lawyer, gets killed.
After his poor cat is tossed out a window.
I know, for no reason. And also, we get a very tense scene where he's walking away and running away through a museum. And then all of a sudden, like, several fingers on his hand get sliced off, and then he's killed.
Yep, stuffed stuffed in a casket or something.
Something like that. So this is a fairly dark movie, and it ends fairly darkly.
The war kicks up. It's full bore now, and no one's allowed to leave the country. And there's a crackdown on minorities, and Zero being a minority, there's a crackdown on him, and... Yeah, Gustav saves his life.
Yeah, well, so let's cut to that final scene. They're back on the train. They're being pulled over by a death squad. This time, initially, it was just the frontier is closing, but now there's an actual death squad there. And the first person they pick up is Gustav. So here's what I'm wondering. Were they going to kill Gustav first, or were they interested in killing Immigrant Zero first?
I think they were going to kill both of them.
Yeah, and we never really know why. We never really know what their ideology is or what the reason why
exactly.
they're targeting
them.
So.
You know, I, being the history nerd, want to know more.
Yeah.
But Gustav, we don't really know much about his background, and he doesn't reveal his background with Zero. So we don't know. He could be a minority. He could have been from a different country. He could have been marked for extermination.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's part of the vaguely French vibe that is also present in this fictitious country. So he could very well be an immigrant running this place. So
right.
And that's kind of the one consistent sense that we got was they were cracking down on immigrants. But it was kind of just there in the background. somehow Zero still ends up with a controlling interest in the hotel. They really kind of gloss over how he ends up, how he comes to own the hotel at the end. There was some negotiation with the government.
He was willed. I think he was.
Well, no, he was willed, but they also mentioned him talking over with the government to because many things got seized by the government, basically. The vibe that I got from that very brief line was that eventually the government just kind of started taking over private property, like nationalizing industries and things like that. And him holding onto the hotel came at the cost of giving up everything else, I guess was the idea.
Including the painting?
Including the painting, because what happens is, because Madame D was murdered, her family gets nothing. And everything, including all of her factories and everything else, goes to...
The state.
Goes to Gustav.
Oh, right.
That was the point of the second will.
Oh, right, right, right.
And then Gustav wrote up a will himself, leaving everything to Zero, which included the entirety of Madame D's fortune. This was my understanding of what happened. Now, again, we only get one very brief line about this, but all of Madame D's other businesses, her factories and things like that, got nationalized. That was the I took that line to mean.
The trade-off was, we'll let you live and you'll keep the hotel, but we get everything
else. We get everything else, exactly. And that's a lot to pack into basically like three lines of exposition. So it's something where you'd really have to have an understanding of the historical period and of what could possibly be happening with this form of government and a lot of things.
At that point, Zero kind of reminds me of Ted Mosby. From How I Met Your Mother,
yes.
In which he keeps his memories of a happy time in his life and a dilapidated hotel, but he gave up the factories. So Ted Mosby lives in the stories because his future's not that bright.
Are you part of the contingent that thinks that the mother has been dead the whole time?
I think so.
All right, we'll table that until after the series ends in a few months.
I would really like to have a conversation about that series, because that series spoke a lot to me several years ago.
All right, so look for a special How I Met Your Mother episode of Film Walk podcast in the future. So anyway, in the end, Gustav is executed.
By firing squad, I believe.
Yes, right then and there. Like, he dies on the train. Right in front of them.
I thought
they take him out.
Yeah, I thought they said that he's eventually killed. So I think they threw him in prison and then shot him later.
Oh, you think? I was under the impression he died immediately. So it's...
Unfortunately, he mouthed off to the wrong death squad guys. Because if he gets mouthed off to Norton and his just military police, he would have been fine.
They tear up his right to travel paper that he got from Edward Norton earlier in the movie.
Which tells me that... Those Henkels and his men are no longer in power.
Well, I guess here's what I wonder. Henkels being Edward Norton's character.
Yes.
I guess here's what I wonder is, if Gustav gets pulled off the train and killed, why do Zero and Agatha survive? Why are they not also?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's fairly vague.
That part is unclear, but we're only left to speculate on that for a moment, because we learn that Gustav is dead and we cut to his funeral, and then we hear a moment later that Agatha also died. Of the Prussian grip, which is... Grip is just the French word for measles. That's how I knew what that meant, but...
And then in our time, it was being, you know, some antibiotics and she'd be good to go, but...
Yeah, which again, feels like a very old-timey way to go, you know?
Consumption.
I don't know. In this way, Zero, and I guess present-day Zero, played by F. Murray Abraham, feels like so many storytellers. And I dare say, storytellers of... indeterminately ethnic descent. Like, I have no idea what Zero's background is supposed to be. I looked him up. He's born in Anaheim, California. I don't know what his...
Well, okay, so he's Californian.
Exactly.
And this was the Great Desert War.
Well, but like, California. I don't want to just bring up Life of Pi and Slumdog Millionaire in the same breath, because it feels racist even bringing those
up.
But
I thought he was Turkish.
It seems like a similar sort of idea of, you know, let's bring in the vaguely ethnic looking immigrant guy and have him tell the horrible story of his upbringing,
sure.
Basically. I wonder if the movie is fetishizing that in some way. Is kind of what came to mind.
A little bit, because his happiest time in his life was when he was directly subordinate to a white master at a hotel.
Yeah, and referred to as lobby boy, which is a fairly demeaning way to refer to that position. You know, I think we call them bellhops.
Now.
But which bellhop probably also comes from some sort of demeaning etymology. But it's
sure. But yeah. So that is interesting. Because
hop to it. I rang a bell. You know.
I felt that he was Turkish, was his background, maybe Armenian. That would make sense. An immigrant to Southeastern Europe.
Let me put it this way. Regardless of what his background was, and regardless of the movie using that framing device, which is now familiar from a couple of other movies, I don't think the movie ever treated that character with anything but the respect that it treated any other character.
Oh,
I think
absolutely.
The relationship between him and Gustav became one of equals as the movie went on. Initially, he's subordinate to Gustav by virtue of his position, but basically they're partners in crime as the movie goes on. This almost feels like a buddy cop movie between the two of
Gustav
them.
Gustav ends up relying rather heavily on Zero to help him out of prison, to just help him get the boy, you know, with Apple.
Yeah, it's like the minute that he knows that he's a capable lobby boy, he's like, okay, you are a capable confidant. You are a capable partner for my various
ventures.
Yeah,
a lobby boy wasn't just someone who, you know, was the lobby boy. You know, he was the number two in the hotel. He's essentially an executive assistant.
Like an ambassador. You know, he's got all the power of the hotel behind him. He's a plenipotentiary of the hotel,
yes.
So, wow, that was a $5 word. I rarely get a chance to use that.
Hey, there you go. $5 word for Glenn.
So I think that's about all I have to say here. I think this movie was quite good. I think that it's part of a continuing trajectory of good movies from Wes Anderson. Fantastic Mr. Fox was solid. I thought Moonrise Kingdom was one of my favorite movies of the year when it came out. And I think this movie could end up in a similar place. So... enjoyed this.
Certainly very enjoyable. Definitely loved all the costumes, the set design, everything involving the visuals of this film was very, very good. The acting was good. The character relationships were pretty solid for the most part. The comically evil family was comically evil.
yes.
But it was enjoyable. And did you catch that Dimitri disappears?
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, there was a one line. It was like a bottom of a paper. It was Dimitri is missing.
Oh, my God. No, I missed that completely.
Yeah,
that's
so
great.
He is killed off screen.
Because we never see what happens to us. We just flash back to the present day, and you know, that the evil family just kind of disappears.
He doesn't survive the war.
Wow. Okay. I'm sure he was not the only one.
Yes. A very interesting film. Might not hit all the points if you were looking for something like a deep discussion of maybe 1930s Europe. It doesn't do that.
I don't think a lot of people went into this movie looking for that.
Hey, I go into every movie saying, what does this tell me about fascism?
Right.
New thing can I take from this movie about fascism? Which apparently is they have wonderful uniforms.
Well, unfortunately, we did not do a podcast about Disney's Frozen, so we won't be able to get into that in any more detail.
I was mainly upset about economics.
Anyway, with that, I think that brings us to the end of our discussion of The Grand Budapest Hotel. If you have any feedback on our discussion, feel free to email us at filmwonknet@gmail.com. Thank you for tuning in at filmwonk.net, and have a good night.